I'm not following trails laid by my political opponents in various newspapers.
Do you think that the fact that, like, you've seemingly consistently associated with maybe people who are, have been labelled as problematic is coincidental?
There is no secret or mystery about anything to do with any Russian oligarch in my professional or private life.
So long as there are no strings, you would be happy taking money from anyone without ethical limits. No strings.
No strings. I think that what students are interested in is the future of the university.
This is the Loaf Podcast. Today we're here with Lord Peter Mandelson, known for spearheading the New Labour campaign alongside Tony Blair, among many other things in his long career. In a few days, we'll know whether or not he'll be the new Chancellor of Oxford. Peter, thank you so much for being with us here today.
It's a great pleasure to be here, although I don't think you should make Tony Blair sound as if he was some sort of also-ran to the New Labour campaign. He was the boss. Yeah, he was the strategist. Yeah. He essentially invented, and all the rest of us filled in and helped him win election and change the country.
Okay. We'll start very basic, something we like to ask all our guests. Peter, when was the last time you changed your mind about something fundamentally important?
Fundamentally important?
So about something that's really maybe fundamental to you on maybe on a value level or general like perception of the world or of politics?
I suppose if I really had to go back into the mists of time, when I was a teenager, I went through a period of being a bit more theoretically left-wing than I am now. I even went for 6 months into the Young Communist League, although, to be honest, that was more for social reasons. Let's not go there, but I mean, I know it sounds very counterintuitive that you should go into the Young Communist League in West Hampstead for social reasons, but I did. Yeah. I didn't last very long. It was hilarious. I went with two other friends. They all made us laugh, and we left, and I came back to the Labour Party. But I think that from very, very soon after that, my politics, my outlook on life settled into a very left of centre view. And approach. And I, broadly speaking, pretty boringly, I'm afraid, kept in the same political groove, you know, through my 20s, 30s, and ever since. I've never really changed. I've always been in one form or another, more or less, New Labour. I may not have called it that, but that's what I was.
Thank you. Yeah, well, it's definitely good to know what you think about things. So that's a positive. But Peter, second round voting for the position of Oxford Chancellor is upcoming this Monday, very soon. And yet I think many people at Oxford aren't actually aware about the specifics of what the role actually entails. So maybe for those people at Oxford or not who are watching, what specifically does the Chancellor of Oxford do?
The chief role of the Chancellor is to be the figurehead only of the university. The Chancellor is very much at the sort of dignified end of the constitutional spectrum of Oxford University. And the chief job is to preside over university occasions and events two or three times a year with dignity. And that I believe I can do. I've been a Chancellor of another university in Manchester for the last 8 years. So I've learned to do that side of the job reasonably well. I think, secondly, to offer advice to the Vice Chancellor and the other officers of the university when that's requested of you. You don't barge in and start trying to lay down the law or tell the Vice Chancellor what to think or mark her homework. That's absolutely off limits. The Chancellor is not there to do that. But if the Vice Chancellor wants to bounce an idea or a view of somebody they can completely trust, then the Chancellor is there. Thirdly, and I think this is going to be really important for the university because there's a big government review of university financing coming down the track towards us, it is to provide a bridge from the university to the government. Now, inevitably, I have long-standing, quite deep connections with the Labour government, just to state the obvious. And I think that what I'd be able to do, therefore, is to represent the university, advance its interests, argue its corner, advocate for the university with the Labour government during the course of that review of university financing. You'd need to travel when you're asked to do so, to go, because this is a global university whose international connections are very important. So you've got to travel and be an ambassador for the university. And lastly, fundraise continuously. I mean, wherever you are, whoever you're in front of, just think, you know, what does this spell? Can I get something out of this for the some university? Well, let's not be vulgar, but yes. Is there money? Are there resources? Is there assistance? I mean, whether it be philanthropy or corporate partnerships, what can you do that's good for the university? And that's what would motivate me. It's a 10-year role, so it's a long time. I would just throw myself into it very enthusiastically. I love the university. I've loved being back here for the campaign. And I feel very, very committed to its welfare, its future, to its traditions, but also how it needs to, you know, size up the future and what's coming towards us and how we need to meet those challenges.
Yeah, you're clearly quite passionate about it as well. And I'm just curious, because a lot of that sounds... some of it sounds quite ceremonial. Some of it sounds really good for the university. But why should students, maybe more grassroots level, why should students care about who Chancellor is? I, for example, I didn't even know who the Chancellor was before this election, so the last Chancellor.
Well, I hope that should I be elected, people will know who their Chancellor is. Certainly receive enough publicity. Look... The job of the Chancellor is not to be the Deputy Vice Chancellor. Mm. It's not to be a university administrator. That's clear. So you're there as a representative, as an ambassador, somebody who projects the iconic status of this great university, its values, its ethos, and to draw people and talent towards it. Whether it be at undergraduate level or postdoc or professorial, you want to bring the best people here, because that's the hallmark of Oxford University, the excellence of the people who work in it.
Thank you, Peter. Yeah, I think being sort of an ambassador is really the important part. And of course, you're very well known around the world. You've been EU Trade Commissioner and so on. Your main competitor, William Hague, is of course also very well known. So before we talk about you, I'd like to ask you a question, which is, what do you think that William Hague might bring to the role? What do you think are his good qualities?
I think he would be somebody who's clearly very committed to the university. I think all those who are standing for Chancellor, all five of us who have made it to the final round, we're all equally committed to the university. It's true that William does have... connections in the rest of the world, as I do, and frankly, he and I see the job very similarly. You know, both to be an ambassador for this university globally, but also somebody who can, you know, help support and give advice to the vice chancellor and colleges here within the university. What I have that he doesn't have, of course, is a relationship with the Labour government. With the best will in the world, he's a conservative, a very strong conservative, very principled conservative. And I'm not saying that nobody would ever take his calls if he were Chancellor of Oxford. Of course they would, because, you know, these Labour ministers are very polite, so they'd take his call. But he wouldn't have the same relationship with them that I have. Who can talk both publicly and be listened to, but also to talk privately and to influence.
To what extent then do you think we should be seeing this as almost a party political election, both with regards to that connection, but also with regards to the policy that you'll be bringing?
don't think it's really party political. I think it's about the credentials of the individual. And, you know, I'm quite sure that if we had a Conservative government in power, he would be the first to point out that as a Conservative, he had such good and close relations with the Conservative government that he would be a more influential Chancellor. Well, by the same token, same goes for me, because we've got a Labour government.
Yeah. So if you were to be elected, let's say, in the next few days, what would you change about university, the way it's run?
Well, can I say straight away that I would not seek to change the way the university is run?
Okay.
I'm not the vice chancellor.
Right.
Okay. If I'm elected chancellor, I'm there to represent the university in the best possible way, to preside over it, to strengthen it, to fundraise for it.
To maybe slightly amend my point, what would you like to be changed, or rather, like, what would you like to stand for? Obviously,
well, I'll tell you what's important to me. Okay.
Yeah.
There are three things that are important to me. One, excellence. Our hallmark is that we are the best. We attract the best people. We offer the best teaching and the best research. And we are unashamedly not elitist as such, in the sense that we don't seek to exclude otherwise and put ourselves on a very sort of selective pinnacle. It's not so much elitism, so much as excellence that we stand for and are committed to. Secondly, I think that because we're an excellent university, we have got to attract the widest possible range of excellent potential students, postdocs, academics, and professors. Okay? So we've got to widen our catchment. We've got to widen as far as possible our reach, so that those who are the best, who are potentially excellent, and would demonstrate that if they came to the university, that they're not excluded by accident, by chance of birth, where they live, the fact that they may well be the first in their families ever to apply to university. I mean, we've got to make an effort as a university to reach out, broaden that access, and make sure that everyone who's eligible to come has the chance to do so. And I think the third thing is this. I've become quite shocked, in a way, by the terms and the conditions and the pay and the living costs and how people make ends meet in this town, of junior academic faculty members, junior research fellows, postdocs and others who are in departments or in colleges, who are looked to and used increasingly, you know, to teach undergraduates alongside the research that they're doing, but frankly lead a fairly hand-to-mouth existence. It's terribly uncertain. They've got no clear career path or trajectory. Everything's very short-term. Their contractual arrangements are hit and miss. They're not paid properly. People offer them lunches and dinners to compensate for the lack of pay. But that's really not sustainable, in my view, for a university like this, number one in the world, a global university, whose its central determination is to maintain those standards of teaching, learning, and research excellence. We can't do that if the pay, the conditions, the pension arrangements of so many academics here are not similarly excellent. Now, I know that the Vice Chancellor has addressed this. She did so right from the word go when she became Vice Chancellor, and she made her first oration when she was when she came into the role. And I know how important the pay and rations and the conditions are and the career structure of academics in the university. But I would want to put whatever weight I have behind that determination to remain excellent, to widen our access, but to make a serious sort of jump up in the way in which we employ academics and remunerate them.
Want your head and hair to feel cool and clean? Been going to extreme measures to cool your head off? Then get yourself a Manscaped. Don't be like Ollie and take your scalp from zero to hero with the new Scalp Buffer now. Use the discount code LOAF to get your 20% off.
Thank you, Peter. Right. Yeah, I think equality of opportunity, of course, is something that I find it quite hard to imagine that people can disagree with, of course, for the individual's sake, but also, like you say, for the excellence of the university. Now, regarding equality of opportunity, the current Labour government has recently just stated that they're going to increase tuition fees. I know you've said that you've noticed that that is, of course, to keep it in line with inflation, but that seems not to align with the view you just expressed there. So if you were in the current Labour government, would you have introduced that measure? And do you agree with it?
Well, I would, but it's an uptick in tuition fees for inflation. It's pretty modest. And for many universities, it's eclipsed by the increase in national insurance charges for employers, which are paid for by this and every other university. So, I mean, you're sort of taking with one hand and giving with the other. And
well, I suppose, if you don't mind me just jumping in, as somebody who's going to be raising funds for the university, I'm sure you're aware how large the endowments of all these colleges are and how much money is actually available. And yet fees are still being increased.
But I'm also, very, very much aware that the endowments in American universities, for example, with whom we compete, are 10 times larger than those that are available to us in Oxford in the colleges. And we cannot keep, as we are doing at the moment, dipping into our savings accounts, as it were, our endowments, in order to meet increasing proportions and sums of our current expenditure. You can't simply do that indefinitely. So, my response is twofold to your question. One is that I'd like the government to recognise the public value of universities, that they're a public good, that they are that not just because of their social importance in our country, but are also a hugely important source of economic prosperity and growth for us in this country. So they are a public good. And that should be recognized by much greater public investment being put into the universities by the government, by the rest of the country. But I don't believe whatever sums they're able as the economy strengthens in the coming years, as I hope it will, I don't think that will ever be enough to enable us to compete effectively with the great American universities. And so that we've got to look to additional private sources of finance for the university. And one of those is private philanthropy, from which we already benefit, but I think we could go up very many notches and levels in how we attract philanthropic gifts and new benefactors to the university. And secondly, we've got to make corporate partnerships, you know, to go to work with the private sector so that, you know, that they're able to benefit from the research that takes place in the university, but in return, you know, pay for it, you know, substantially and significantly. So whilst I think that we always have to protect the integrity, the autonomy, the independence of the university, we can't have the university being, you know, run by philanthropists or the shots being called by, you know, businesses. I mean, I don't want to get into a situation where he or she or they who, you know, pay the piper call the tune in this university. I don't want that.
Right.
But there is a sensible relationship that you can have both with philanthropists and others in the private sector that mutually benefit both, but leave the integrity and the independence of the university intact.
Yeah, I suppose I'm not sure how fruitful that comparison with America is, given how large the endowments are at each college, but we'll move on from there and then I'll allow Lukas to continue. You mentioned the relationship with the government. What do you think the government should be doing to help universities in specifics, given, as you know, how tight money is at the moment? What sort of initiatives should Keir Starmer, as Prime Minister, be putting into place?
Universities have got to be able to plan for the long term. You know, the sort of short term, you know, let's put a little raise here for inflation, but then take it away there through national insurance. It's not possible for universities to plan financially in a sustainable way unless they have, you know, a 3, 4, 5 year time horizon financially. And this both goes for teaching and research. I want to see a more substantial teaching grant come to the universities from the government, out with the tuition fees that students pay. I'd like to see, incidentally, more investment by the government in postdocs for us. I mean, we need graduates coming into the university who take on the challenges of D fields. These people are going to be the Nobel Prize winners of the future. And we've got to invest in them at the early stage and to bring them into universities like this one. So I'd like to see that, and I'd like to see more investment in science, in the sciences and technology. So both the humanities and social sciences, natural sciences, technology, and mathematics. These are the great activities of universities like this, which are essentially, you know, the seed corn for our country's future. I believe that the prosperity of Britain, our future prosperity as a country, is going to be built on the shoulders of the great research-intensive universities like our own in Oxford. And that's why they've got to see what they put into the universities over a much longer period as a key investment, and not just a constant sort of short-term set of pieces of elastoplast, just, you know, forcing the universities to continue in what is frankly, financially, a completely makeshift way.
Thank you. I think that covers a lot of the bases there, and obviously our audience can make up their minds whether or not they agree with you on that point. I think we'll move it on to a different topic. William Hague, your opponent in this, one of your opponents rather, in this next election, has mentioned that the country wants or wanted some transparency on your dealings with the Russian oligarch Deripaska. Do you think this has been provided?
There is no secret or mystery about anything to do with any Russian oligarch in my professional or private life.
Right. So would you maintain that your meetings with Deripaska had nothing to do with EU trade on restrictions with aluminium?
Absolutely not.
Right. So I suppose then the next question...
I'm not quite sure what a conversation about aluminium between us would consist of. But anyway, I mean, no is the answer.
Do you think that the fact that, like, you've seemingly consistently associated with maybe people who have been labelled as problematic is coincidental?
Look, I'm sorry. I want to talk to you about the university.
Right.
Let's leave all this other stuff to... The newspapers.
I do,
thank
yeah,
you very
but I do
much.
Think it is. No,
no I'm telling. Enough. I'd like to talk about my outlook on life, what I bring to the university.
Yeah.
I'm not following trails laid by my political opponents in various newspapers.
I'll pass it to Oliver. I do think, though, as a
I think we should concentrate, if you don't mind.
Yes, we will.
On the substance of this.
Yeah.
Because, as I say, I'm not going to follow trails
that's fine.
Laid by my political opponents through various tabloid newspapers.
As I was
Thank
saying,
you
yeah,
very
I'll pause
it
to all of it. I do think, though, that like the students might be interested in. That's the only reason.
I think that what students are interested in is the future of the university.
Okay.
The future of our country, our economic prospects, and how we're going to turn this country round after what has been a pretty sorry decade just gone.
Thank you. So, I think
Thank you. We'll move it on in that case. I'd like to talk about perhaps the university's relation to the EU, in specific, the university's relation to institutions over there. Of course, you've been staunchly pro-European for a long time. How do you think we should proceed in our relations with the EU, both as a country and as a university, post-Brexit?
Well, I think it's got to go in stages. First of all, I think we've got to rebuild the mutual trust and respect that we've lost, given the way that successive British governments have behaved in recent years towards the European Union. There's a lot of rebuilding of trust and basic respect. Secondly, we've got to try and chip away at some of the major trade barriers, disadvantages, and costs that we've taken on as a result of Brexit. You may have heard the Governor of the Bank of England speaking last night in London, where he said that economically, Brexit weighs very heavily on us as a country. You know, not for him to take sides in the referendum one way or the other, but he is a very key player in our economy. And for him to say that our economy as a whole continues to be seriously weighed down by our departure from the European Union and its vast single trading market means that where it's possible to sort of reduce or mitigate the costs and the risks from Brexit, we've got to do so. Thirdly, where we can re-establish our part in key European programs, for example, the Horizon Science Programme, which has been a source of enormous sort of strength as well as finance, the collaboration between researchers, academics in this university and others in European universities, that ecosystem of academic research is absolutely vital. And so we've got to do everything we can to remake and to restore our place in those ecosystems as fast as we can. In the longer term, there are, for example, areas of activity, collaboration, policy like defence and security, or energy supply and generation, or combating climate change, where it makes complete sense for us to work more closely with our European neighbours. Now, if, as we go through these stages of rebuilding and restoring and repairing the relationship between us and our biggest export market in the world, which is Europe's single market, if beyond that, you know, Europe changes, attitudes in this country change, and there's a growing convergence of view that we can, if there's potential for it, rethink our longer-term relationship, then so be it. But that's not going to come easily or quickly, either on our part or that of the European Union.
Yeah, I agree largely with your practical steps and that the idea that we should create a rapprochement with the EU. The problem for me is that, of course, the Remain campaign failed, and now Nigel Farage, although, of course, there's much more to that, has had recent electoral success. And I think there's a fair amount of general Euroscepticism which remains in the UK. And beyond practical action, I think that'll create friction for you, were you to be Chancellor, in getting us closer to the European Union again, and as a country getting closer to the European Union again.
Can I just stop you a moment? Mm-hmm. We've got many continental European colleagues in this university. Mm-hmm. Who have been very seriously hit and damaged in their lives, their families, their prospects for work and what they do in the university, hit by this rupture that we inflicted on ourselves. Now, we've got to try and address their needs and their concerns. So as well as rebuilding working relations between ourselves and other European universities, we've got to do much more to help reduce the burden that's fallen on European academics and their families who have chosen to work here or want to do so in the future. We've got to make it easier, in other words, for both sides to work together.
Of course, and I certainly agree with that point. I guess what I was trying to address is the idea that because of that Euroscepticism, which remains, your job may be made more difficult. So why do you think that remains, and how can
Sorry, I'm not quite sure why it makes my job more difficult.
In
what respect?
Creating the rapprochement between the university and the EU. You'll be working, of course, with other people.
But it's what the university wants.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly what it needs.
Sure, but the great attention there may make it more difficult for you to bring that closer together, given that it's not just you who's working there, there's other people. So my question is, as a result, why you think that sentiment remains and how we can address that in order to facilitate both what you're doing, but also as a country getting closer to EU in general.
I think that people take increasingly in this country a more pragmatic view of our relationship. I mean, even those who voted to leave the European Union, who haven't seen all the great advantages that were promised during the referendum, think that perhaps pragmatically we can find different and better ways of getting along and working together. And whatever it is, whether it be on trade and economics or energy or defence or security or climate change or whatever it is, there are many areas. I mean, you take migration to this country and illegal migration. That doesn't start at Dover. It starts, on the continent, and therefore working with other countries, for example, to tackle criminal gangs. Who are people smugglers and who are earning huge amounts of money at great sort of human and collateral cost to the people they're exploiting. We can't deal with these issues by ourselves. We need to work with other countries, other governments, other police forces and intelligence agencies if we're going to make an impact on these and other very serious challenges that we have.
I hate to be the one to keep bringing it to maybe more controversial points, but as many people are concerned or might be concerned, you will be named ambassador to the US for the UK.
Sorry, what's the question?
That's the question. It's not a question. It's a statement, and you can respond to that.
I've got nothing to say to it. I mean, I read these things in the press like everyone else. I mean, I've even heard my name coupled to the vacancy of Archbishop of Canterbury. Is there no end to
as far as you're concerned,
to this speculation?
There's just no truth to it as far as you're concerned.
I am not a practicing Anglican.
I was referring to the ambassador position.
Oh, I see. Sorry.
There's no truth to it as far as you're aware.
Nobody has spoken to me
right.
and asked
okay.
me whether I am able or willing to do that.
Thank you for the clarification.
Job.
Yeah,
okay. If it's in their mind, it ain't been communicated to me yet.
Yeah, so I suppose I'll ask you then, were you to be suggested both? Or were you to have the choice?
Archbishop or?
No, let's put the Archbishop thing to the side for the moment, if that's all right with you. I don't know.
I mean, it comes with a good gaff, I gather. I mean, that Lambeth Palace, that's, really.
Well, maybe further down the line, but for the moment, if we can focus on something that seems a bit more realistic, given your conversion to Anglicanism, or you're not a practicing Anglican, right? So it seems unrealistic for the moment.
Feel a bit embarrassed of having this conversation under the shadow of the great cathedral here at
right.
Christchurch. I feel like a sort of thunderbolt might suddenly come in.
Right, well, I think that sounds like there's maybe some reflection in your personal life about religion that might be needed there, but before you can move on to that, I wanted to ask you about the two positions, which, even though you have never explicitly been asked, seem to be in contention. Were you to be offered to be ambassador to the US and to be Oxford Chancellor, which would you definitively choose?
Well, one hasn't been offered and the other is subject to an election. So, I mean, it's more than a hypothetical question.
But
I mean,
you would have a preference, right? You would have a preference.
But let's be absolutely clear about this. One is a role in Oxford and the other is a job that you're talking about.
Right.
They are not the same. This is chalk and cheese here. And if if in the event of this scenario that you describe arising, what would I do? Well, I suspect I'd be spending an awful lot of time advancing Oxford's interests in America, and I would be probably spending quite a lot of time attracting American philanthropy to Oxford. But it isn't on offer, so it right. ain't on. It isn't on the table.
Of course.
But I mean, I know that many people think that it would be a perfect fit, perfect match. I really don't have a view on that. All I know is that I'm standing for the role, to which I hope I will be elected in the coming week. You know, it's let's keep it in perspective. It's going to be a, if I'm lucky enough to be elected, it will be a busy role. It will take a lot of energy on my part. I will be totally committed to promoting the university, protecting the university, and protecting, by the way, the values of the university and the academic freedom and freedom of expression that exists in the university. So I'll be doing all those things. And at the same time, if I'm asked to do something, you know, for the government or for the country, well, of course, you know,
right. So consider that. Yeah, of course. So if we can move it then maybe back to your potential role as Chancellor at Oxford here and talk about one of your primary roles or what one of your primary roles would be, which would be to secure funding now without going into specifics. Often where Oxford and other universities get their funding is a big topic of controversy. So I suppose I would ask you where your ethical limits are for where Oxford would be getting its money.
Give me an example of a line that you think might have been crossed or could be crossed.
Oh, I wouldn't like to speak about anything specific, but I know often, for example, with specific billionaires around the world or with specific conflicts going on, often there are universities in America, for example, okay. Also, which take funding from specific places.
Let me give you a straight answer.
Yeah.
No strings.
So to clarify, so long as there are no strings, you would be happy taking money from essentially anyone without ethical limits.
First of all, it wouldn't be me who's taking
Oxford,
the money.
Of course, it's where you're getting it.
Oxford has so many, you know, hoops and hurdles to go through and cross before people's money is accepted, quite rightly. But the important thing is that if we are importing American scale or levels of philanthropy, that we're not also importing at the same time certain elements or aspects of American behavior concerning philanthropy to universities, where we know that donors, benefactors have tried on occasions to exercise an influence over university policies. Recently, you've had a great commotion for reasons that we fully understand over Gaza, for example. And you had, you know, boards of benefactors in American universities weighing in very heavily with their views on that. Now, that's not a system that we're going to incorporate into our university. Our university's policies are made by our university officers, our vice chancellor in particular, our university council, not by boards of benefactors. Nor do we accept influence over admissions policies to colleges and any attempt being made to influence those by benefactors. We don't have that here. And so we have to be very careful in advancing philanthropy that we make sure that we retain the independence, standards, integrity of the university. And I feel quite passionately about that. So that when some people throw around, oh, I'm just going to sort of haul in billions of dollars and, you know, I'm going to employ this great sort of McKinsey, whatever, to, you know, throw the doors and windows of the university open to all comers. We need philanthropy, but we do not need certain aspects or elements or features of American behavior associated with that philanthropy, which has been damaging to an extent to those American universities standing. So we want the philanthropy. It does have to grow, but we have to maintain the standards of the university. And I feel that quite strongly.
So the chancellor, vice chancellor, the university, do you think there's maybe a moral aspect to it as well when it comes to accepting money?
Moral in the sense of?
In the sense of, for example, let's say hypothetically Russia were to offer £1 million to the university. Would that just be a straight up no? Or a Russian individual of high power?
I think it'd be very difficult to see the circumstances in which somebody, you know, flew in from Russia and offered to write a check for £1 million and we'd just simply embrace it.
Right.
That's not going to happen.
Right.
And we've got to be careful also about accepting money from individuals where there is a state influence over those individuals. So we do not want state influence coming into the university through the back door via individual donations. So we've got to be careful, but the university is already very scrupulous and very careful about this, and those standards have got to be maintained.
Thank you, Peter. We've really enjoyed this interview. We've enjoyed the time. As we wrap up, we'd like to ask you to finish. Why should people vote for you in a short, concise way?
I think people should vote for me because I bring something from outside the university that will enhance it, add to what it already has. Somebody who is able to promote the university and be a good communicator for the university, and somebody who can provide a bridge, a relationship with the UK government, whose policies are going to have a big influence on where this university goes. So in all those three respects, I think I can do a job for the university as well as preside over it with dignity.
Thank you, Peter. This has been the Loaf Podcast with Lord Peter Mandelson. We look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you, Peter.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Cheers.